Hey, I'm Ryan Reynolds.
At Mint Mobile, we like to do the opposite of what Big Wireless does. They charge you a lot, we charge you a little. So naturally, when they announced they'd be raising their prices due to inflation, we decided to deflate our prices due to not hating you. That's right. We're cutting the price of Mint Unlimited from $30 a month to just $15 a month.
Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month slows. Full terms at mintmobile.com.
Follow the money. That's what we're doing on the Gegenpod today. Extraordinary circumstances with what's happened at Manchester City. And Kieran Maguire, football finance expert, is our special guest. He joins former Premier League star Thomas Sorensen and Socceroos icon Mark Schwarzer as we talk about Chelsea's massive spending, Newcastle's business model, and what's going on with the sales of Man United and Liverpool. Plenty of other stories in the Premier League too, with Jesse Marsh, the latest managerial casualty. We'll check in on it all. I'm your host, Teo Pelizzeri. This is the Optus Sport Football Podcast. Let's get in to the Gegenpod. Yes, it is all about the money on the Gegenpod today. We have a very special guest joining us, the author of and host of the podcast, The Price of Football, Kieran Maguire, and he's joining former Premier League star Thomas Sorensen and Socceroos icon Mark Schwarzer. Kieran, it's great to have you on the show to offer us a unique perspective, and I understand that you are a man in incredible demand worldwide right now, given what's going on in Premier League football.
I've just come off BBC Arabic. I've done Norway, Denmark, CNN, and 20 UK stations and a couple in Ireland as well. Football and finance shouldn't be a topic. We don't fall in love with the game due to amortization, but they seem to want somebody to talk about it at present, given the machinations at Chelsea and Manchester City.
Well, what better place to start? I'm going to throw the floor open to Thomas and Mark to actually ask you the questions about what's going on with Manchester City. Mark, let's start with your perspective before we get into quizzing Kieran about what it all means, because it was an extraordinary bombshell the way that the Premier League broke this news.
Huge, absolutely huge bombshell. I mean, I think for some people, obviously knew there was some ongoing investigations going on, but I don't think anyone ever in their wildest dreams ever thought it would be as dramatic and as serious as it seemingly is. And I think it's taking quite a long time to digest. I mean, I certainly haven't digested anywhere near enough of the information since it was released. So let's hope it gets sorted out sooner rather than later. I mean, what the repercussions are going to be, what the actual penalties are going to be, only time will tell. But I'll be very interested to hear what Kieran's take is on it as well, moving forward to see what, you know, what he thinks the possible ramifications can be or will be likely.
Well, there's 115 charges. The Premier League has effectively said that Manchester City has misrepresented all of its, or a significant amount of its accounts, for a period of 9 years. So it's a long accusation of deceit. And I think we can probably narrow it down to two core areas. First of all, City have been overstating the money that's coming. So they've got sponsorship deals from the likes of Etihad. And the accusation is that the money was actually coming from the club owner. And the problem with that is it doesn't count towards FFP if it's from the owner. So it's been disguised as sponsorship income. Then when it comes to wages, the accusation is that Roberto Mancini was on a salary of 1.45 million sterling from Manchester City. But he had a consultancy arrangement with another club based in Abu Dhabi who were paying him 1.75 million for 4 days' work a year. And the Premier League are saying, well, hold on, yeah, that's not a realistic arrangement. That's actually disguising Mancini's wages. And I think they've done something similar with Yaya Toure and his agent in terms of how the fees have gone there. And then the third element of the charges is that Manchester City have obstructed the Premier League in terms of its investigation. The investigation started in 2018, and that's part of the reason why it's taken over 4 years to reach the point where it released charges. I understand that Manchester City are very, very angry, however, because normally you would be given a heads up that something is going to be released, and nobody at City knew what was going to happen until it appeared on the Premier League website.
You know, I think this whole issue is something that really shakes it all to the core. I think, you know, what makes football great is that we believe in what we're seeing on the field, that what we see is true, and that, you know, to some extent that it's fair, and we all play by the same rules. And by these things coming out, you know, that, you know, can we believe anything that we're seeing? You know, if clubs, and especially the top clubs, the you know, the bearers, and the clubs that we all look up to, I think, you know, if they're doing these sort of things, it puts the whole game in disrepute. You know, and you know, the fans are paying their hard-earned money to go and watch this. You know, everyone who's involved, who's employed in football, I think, you know, so there's so much at stake here. You know, that you know, if it is as bad as it's laid out to be, it's a huge thing.
Yes, I mean, lots of people have commented that how can Manchester City's commercial income be 20% higher than that of Manchester United? And that's no disrespect to Manchester City. Yeah, they've been magnificent on the pitch. But if there's not a level playing field off the pitch, or at least if people are not playing by the same rules, you can see a loss of faith. We've seen what's happened in Italy with regards to Juventus and the 15-point penalty, and the whole board of directors have had to walk away, and people have been banned from football. You have the likes of Agnelli. What's going to happen to the director of football at Spurs as well because of his involvement? So when we get a final resolution to this, either the board at Manchester City would probably have to resign if Manchester City lose the case. If they successfully defend it, where does that leave the Premier League?
Kieran, is it... it's kind of strange. Like you said, normally the club gets a heads up from the Premier League. Why do you think that's not the case in this instance? And is it because maybe they think there's such compelling evidence to say that they're in big trouble, they're in deep water? Or what else can you think why they would do what they've done? And what do you think the overall outcome might be?
Well, I think looking at your first issue, Mark, the relationship between Manchester City and the Premier League perhaps is not a good one. There's certainly been a lot of lobbying from other clubs, especially the bigger clubs, in terms of putting pressure on the Premier League to progress this. There's another issue here in the UK at present, in that the UK government were due to release, they were due to publish a proposal to instigate an independent regulator of football. This was on the basis of a fairly long drawn out process where a lot of fan groups, lots of owners of smaller clubs as well, they were unhappy with the governance of the game. The Premier League is opposed to this. The Premier League wants to regulate itself, and I think the timing is it's more than a coincidence, in the sense that now the Premier League can say, well, look, we're trying to put our house in order. The fact that we're prepared to take on not only the Manchester City, who are our present champions, you know, that they are our flag bearers, they are shareholders, they are stakeholders in our game, and also that they've successfully defended themselves against accusations from UEFA. Well, we're still, this is a sign of just how good we are at the Premier League, in order to try to persuade members of Parliament that when it comes to a final vote, that there's no need, or at least there will be a very diluted version of the proposals to have an independent regulator in the UK game.
Yeah, okay, and do you think it will stop here? Because we've obviously seen, you know, plenty of owners coming in. Todd Bowley at Chelsea. We saw the Saudi Arabia consortium taking over Newcastle. You know, there's talks, obviously, the sales of United and Liverpool to prospective Middle Eastern or American owners. You know, is there other people that need to look over their shoulder, or how do you see it?
Well, I think from an investor's point of view, all of a sudden I'd be slightly nervous, especially if I was thinking of buying a club. If something like this could happen, which could effectively destroy the value of my investment. And people might not be aware that 17% of Manchester City is owned by a US investment house. So Abu Dhabi United have sold a large, you know, a significant proportion of Manchester City or the City Football Group to a company called Silver Lake. You can imagine them being absolutely furious at present. In terms of, are there other clubs that could be under investigation? Well, we did see, for example, Everton claim that they had 190 million sterling of COVID losses, and other clubs were reporting losses of 60 or 70 million. So why is it that Everton have got three times the value of the COVID losses? And I was aware that both Leeds and Burnley were thinking of launching effectively a private prosecution against Everton had they been relegated. And in the end, they decided Leeds stayed up and they lost enthusiasm. I think Burnley, that they were getting nothing positive from the Premier League. But for all we know, the Premier League could be investigating this. We've just had the Chelsea spending splurge, although in my view that's within the rules. So increased scrutiny could certainly be the case going forwards. And again, that might be part of the reason why we've got both Liverpool and Manchester United presently up for sale.
So before we get to Chelsea and some of the other Premier League powerhouses, I just wanted to ask about that independent regulator and perhaps that process might be pushed back by the Premier League showing they can keep their house in order. How would you assess the desire from fans for fairness and regulation versus the sort of the power of global brands and teams and their fans from around the world, just wanting them to be as strong as possible? And the truth is on the pitch, the 11 that get there, they don't care how they get there or how they're paid to get there or how much it cost to put those 11 players together. Do you think there is actually a bit of an ideological tug of war between competitive balance measures and just let the best assemble themselves, however it may come to pass?
Oh, certainly. It becomes a very tribal issue, and it depends upon which team that you support. So we've seen Jurgen Klopp, we've seen Liverpool fans saying, we feel that we are in a disadvantaged position, because when they look up, they see Chelsea lost over 900 million sterling under Roman Abramovich. When Chelsea played Manchester City 2 years ago in the Champions League final, those two clubs were the biggest loss-making clubs in Premier League history. And yet they were being rewarded by having the flagship match of the European football regime. So those fans tend to be resentful. If you talk to a fan of Newcastle, they say, bring it on. You know, they don't want any regulation. They'd happily scrap financial fair play today. And that's because an awful lot of fans are hypocrites. And not, I don't mean that in a negative way. It's because if somebody flies in who is a multi-billionaire, who is a sugar daddy, and that's what fans are looking for, because fans want more money spent on their club. If it loses money and those losses are underwritten by somebody, well, the fans don't care. They just want to see the best on the pitch. The danger is what happens at some point when the owner's circumstances change, and we saw that with Roman Abramovich at Chelsea. We've seen that at other clubs as well, where the owner's business has gone bust. Or what happens if the owner says, actually, I'm bored. You know, I've got this expensive executive toy and I've just realised how much it's cost me. I've got friends that own racehorses and they say the best 2 days of owning a racehorse is the day that you buy it and the day that you sell it. Well, you talk to football club owners and they'll often say very similar.
Kieran, what do you think the actual outcome will be with Manchester City in this instance? Do you think they'll be relegated? Do you think they'll be expelled from the league? And I mean, we're even reading some reports that the EFL then might decide that they wouldn't accept them in the competition. I mean, I just find that really hard to believe that would be a possibility.
I think relegation would be unlikely, because if the Premier League were not going to sanction its members for setting up the Super League, and effectively threatening to reduce the value of the domestic game, then picking on one club and relegating it does seem much harsher. And in my view, the Super League was a far bigger threat to the Premier League than Manchester City. If they've done wrong, they've cheated, they've broken the rules, and a points deduction would appear to be the logical tariff, because a financial penalty isn't going to be of any detriment to the owners. So it then says, well, you know, how much should this points deduction be? Should it be 15 points? Should it be 30 points? Should it be this season? I can't see the commission reaching its conclusions by the end of this season. So is it that Manchester City starts next season on minus 15, minus 25, minus 30 points?
But surely they can't win the league with this hanging over their head. You know, if they get themselves in a position, I mean, how is that going to look?
It's going to look awful, which again goes back to why has the Premier League waited until February to make this decision? So I think politics has overridden sort of the sense. The logical time to do it is either to do it at the end of the season or to do it in the summer, so that everybody knows where they stand. And that also, of course, has an impact upon players as professional athletes. Do you want to join a club with this cloud hanging over its head? Do you feel uneasy as a professional because you are you guilty by association? You know, in terms of the sins of others at the club, and therefore the timing has made a difficult situation worse. You're absolutely right. If they end up with the highest number of points this season, then it could become farcical if during the summer the commission reaches a conclusion and says either A, you're going to have a points deduction at the start of the 23-24 season, or B, we're now going to take 15 or 20 points away, because they've already had the open bus tour that, you know, Arsenal fans have already, you know, would, if they don't win the Premier League, they've already be frustrated. Winning it that way would be awful.
We've seen clubs, though, in the past have titles stripped. So, I mean, look, if the worst case were to happen, obviously it's all hypothetical at the moment, but, you know, we've seen it in the past. Clubs have had titles stripped.
That they have. I mean, if we look to see what happened in Scotland with Rangers, they ended up with a demotion, but they didn't have the title stripped, except in the minds of Celtic fans. So it really is a case of how severe are the nature of these allegations. Yeah, what are the numbers involved? And has there been an attempt to effectively pull the wool over the eyes of the Premier League on a long period of time by Manchester City's executives, and therefore the Premier League says, we don't think that you deserve anything from the period in which this misfeasance was taking place?
Yeah, no, I just wanted to again touch on the titles, because, you know, you know I lost an FA Cup final to Manchester City in 2011. Yaya Toure, who was involved, scored. Not that I want any winner's medal from it, but again, yeah, I think it, you know, there's a big argument for, you know, like we've seen with Lance Armstrong in other sports, where, you know, you actually, you know, cut in where it hurts. That's points deduction, taking away titles. I think, you know, instead of a financial, you know, penalty, I think those things are where the committee should look. I think if they're found guilty, we still have to obviously make that comment. So, yeah, so it'd be interesting to see.
Yes, I mean, a financial penalty would be laughed at by everybody. The Manchester City fans will laugh at it because they know that the owners will be unaffected. The fans of other clubs will think it makes a mockery of the whole process, and the process has taken a long period of time, and therefore, you know, other fans, and you've only got to look at social media in terms of the very, very vehement opposites that fans are taking. If it's just financial I don't think the commission would have a lot of credibility in the eyes of anybody, and they would be laughed at by the fans of Manchester City. So it would have to be more severe than that, unless it happens that Manchester City are cleared of 90 of the charges, and the only charges that stick are that they didn't particularly cooperate with the Premier League in exactly the way that we've seen with the issues with UEFA, where in the end Manchester City were cleared of the charges which led to the initial 2-year ban by UEFA, but were effectively found guilty of not cooperating with UEFA, and they ended up paying a €10 million fine on the back of that. Although City have argued all along that UEFA had been leaking to friendly parties in the media the progress of the case against Manchester City, and therefore they decided to stop cooperating as a result of that.
You did touch on Chelsea, and you said that what they're doing, you believe, is within the rules. So I need to ask, are they just years ahead of the curve? Do they have the financial means to take this sort of a risk? Is it purely a faith investment that the players will not simply become like another Chelsea past player, Winston Bohata, and if they're not good enough to play, they'll collect their wage and Chelsea will be on the hook for tens of millions a year for players they don't want anymore? Explain to us why Chelsea are within the rules, and do you think they are setting a precedent that other clubs will inevitably follow?
In my position as an accountant, I'm pretty certain they are within the rules, and it's due to the unusual way that we treat football players as assets, is that if you sell a player, all of the profit goes into the calculations immediately. And if that player has come through the academy, there's no transfer fee as well, so the sale of the player is pure profit. So if you take a look at Chelsea in 21-22, they sold Mark Guehi, they sold Tammy Abrahams, they sold Figuma Tomori, and they probably made around about 80 to 90 million in sales and profits at the same time. But when it comes to buying a player, the cost of the player is spread over the life of the contract via an accounting method called amortization. So if you sign a 100 million player on a 4-year contract, that works out as 25 million a year. What Chelsea have done is said, well, you know, normally when you recruit a high profile player, it will be a 4-year, perhaps a 5-year deal. But they've said, no, we're going to go eight and a half years for some of the people that we're recruiting. So 100 million spread over 8 years reduces the cost for financial fair play purposes to 12.5 million a year. That's the good bit from Chelsea's point of view. The risk, as you were intimating, was that if the player is not of a Chelsea standard, or if the player, for whatever reason, just doesn't fit in, you know, due to the style or the culture of the club or whatever, then you've got a player who's on a Chelsea level of wages. Now, there's not many places to go up from Chelsea. You know, Chelsea are right at the top end of the wage market. So then the player has to make that decision as a professional. Do I sit out the next 6 years on a salary which I will know will not be matched elsewhere? Or am I prepared to take a pay cut? Or do Chelsea go to the player and try to come up with a financial settlement to try to encourage him to leave? That could be very, very costly. You could end up with, given the number of players that Chelsea have signed, you could end up with 4 or 5 players for whom they're on the hook for the next 4 to 5 years, 6 or 7 years in some cases, and they're not getting a return because the player's simply not going to be on the pitch. You know, I wasn't even aware that Victor Moses was at Chelsea until around about 6 months ago. He was one of those players that came and I thought he'd been sold years ago, and then you find out they go out on loan. In the case of Danny Drinkwater, who went to Chelsea from Leicester, Chelsea was sending him out on loan and paying 100% of his wages. So it can work out as very expensive for the club if the relationship doesn't work out between the two parties.
Let's move on to Manchester United, because there have been some headlines about the Glazers being potentially interested in a sale, but they have brought in a name, the media, to the conversation, who has appeared a couple of times on other club sales in the past, Sir Jim Ratcliffe. And so my question, Kieran, is is Sir Jim Ratcliffe the go-to billionaire to make it seem like your club is about to get sold, or is this actually genuine?
My understanding from Manchester is that Manchester United and the Glazers are very unhappy with Sir Jim Ratcliffe waving his hat around saying, I'm the guy to buy the club, because I don't think the price he's willing to pay is anywhere near what the Glazers are looking for. Everybody else is behaving in a more private matter, a private manner, and dealing with the Rain Group, who are the organisation who sold Chelsea on behalf of Roman Abramovich and the UK government. And they would much rather that negotiations and offers took place behind closed doors. So Sir Jim Ratcliffe is the richest man in the UK. He has made his money through being smart and by not paying too much. He's got involved with French football, and I think it's fair to say the results there have been mixed. So whilst he might be emotionally very attractive to Manchester United fans because he's from the area, he used to go to Old Trafford as a kid, you can see the attraction from a fan perspective, I think there's a little bit of mischief from his part, and he's either trying to get a discount, or he's actually just trying to get a bit of publicity in exactly the way that he threw his hat into the ring in respect of Chelsea.
Kieran, have you got any inside information in terms of, or knowledge, are Manchester United close to anything? Is there any genuine buyers out there that you may feel that Manchester United could be sold sooner rather than later? Because obviously the relationship between the fans and the Glazers, everyone knows, has been, let's just say, a real roller coaster of a ride for everyone concerned.
I don't think, from the people I speak to, there's a huge amount of interest at the price that the Glazers are looking for. So either they have to accept something which is more realistic, and there's no doubt that the Chelsea sale was a catalyst for both the Glazers and Fenway Sports Group in terms of putting those clubs up to see who was going to bite. On any normal business valuation model, you would not pay 2.5 billion sterling for any business which had lost a million a week for 19 years. So under those circumstances, that both Manchester United and Liverpool are run on far more sustainable business models, you would expect them to be sold at a much higher price. But it could be argued that Todd Boehly and Clearlake, they got it wrong and they overpaid for Chelsea, especially given that realistically, if they want Chelsea to compete as we go forward in some form of financial fair play regime, they either have to move from Stamford Bridge, because it's only got a capacity of 41,000, or they need to do what Spurs have done and knock it down and replace it with something far bigger. But Spurs is in an area of London which isn't that desirable. Chelsea is.
The problem you've got, obviously, with the difference with Chelsea is that, as I understand, is if the club wants to move, they have to have an agreement with the fans who own the pitch. Is that right? And if they don't come in an agreement, they lose the name. They have to change their name. Is that correct?
That's absolutely correct. Ken Bates, who was a former owner of Chelsea, I think it's fair to say he was quite a controversial person. But the one thing he did, which was really in the interests of the fans, was that he divided the Chelsea pitch up into 1 meter squares, and he then sold all of those squares to individual fans, and no one fan is allowed to own more than 10. So it's impossible for the ground to be sold unless you get the approval of Chelsea pitch owners, who also own, as you rightly said, Mark, the name of Chelsea Football Club. So that means that whatever happens going forwards has to meet the approval of the fan base. And this is actually where, you know, owners can do something which I think meets the approval of all the fans. And it could be that the fans will say, actually, we don't mind moving because it is going to be to a 60 or 70,000 capacity stadium, and the transport links are going to be better. And we're going to call it the new bridge or whatever, and that they see the benefits, but at least they will have some input into the destiny of Chelsea as to whether they stay at the present location or they move on.
So if I was to ask you, Kieran, if you were a buyer, which club do you perceive to be more valuable? Is it Liverpool or Manchester United? Factoring in, of course, the global commercial reach, also the established names of the two brands, what do you think is actually the better investment?
I think the better long-term investment would probably be Manchester United, because they have had more titles in more recent years. The advantage of Liverpool is that under the Fenway Sports Group, they have redeveloped the ground. Yeah, there's capacity of Anfield is going up to 61,000. In respect of Manchester United, I think it no longer qualifies under UEFA rules to host finals, because the quality of the infrastructure there simply isn't up to the high standards. So whoever comes in would have to, again, you know, in terms of what we've just been saying in respect of Chelsea, realistically they'd have to knock down Old Trafford and build it from scratch. And Manchester United could sell out 90,000, 95,000 every week. If you go down that route, if you try to build a bit like a Jenga or a Lego model in terms of what we have already at Old Trafford, it will start to look very messy. So I think Manchester United would be more expensive, but on a long-term basis, it's probably got a greater return on that investment. That's not to be critical of Liverpool, because Liverpool have come from a place where the club was in crisis. You know, under Hicks and Gillette, the Liverpool Football Club was a complete mess, and Fenway Sports Group have progressed it. But I think the ceiling for Manchester United is probably higher than that of Liverpool in terms of commercial appeal.
And Kieran, do you not think in regards to, you know, there's been talks about, you know, a sale price of £6-8 billion that, you know, for the Glazers to sell the club, with the stadium in mind, the infrastructure and that going forward, the expense of that, do you not think that in case they're moving that price to a more, you know, attractive area, that it's going to be really difficult to sell, despite, you know, the massive money machine and the equity that is at Manchester United?
I agree with you totally, Thomas. I mean, the Glazers, I think they've got a little bit greedy following the Chelsea sale, saying, well, yeah, we're such a bigger club than Chelsea that we can get 2.5-3 times the price of Chelsea. But Stretford is not the same as the West End of London. So from a property point of view, the value of the land there is lower. And although you can make more money on a match day basis at Old Trafford, there has to be a ceiling for that as well. And you know, the Glazers have come in for a lot of criticism. One of the things which I think they could be given some credit for is that they've not increased season ticket prices at Old Trafford for the last 10 years, because the local fan base has a ceiling as to what they can afford. Now, it could be that Manchester United, say, under the new owners, said, well, we're going to get rid of some of the old fans, or if we do expand the stadium, it's all going to go to football tourists who are far more lucrative. But then that means that the new owners will have a toxic relationship. They'll effectively inherit from the Glazers. I don't think Manchester United is worth that, but we have a saying in business, there's what's referred to as the bigger fool theory, in that you only need one person who's prepared to go and pay that price. And we've seen that with, you know, the likes of cryptocurrencies and so on, where it doesn't appear to be anything particularly sustainable about it. But if you sell it well enough, then you'll find somebody that will pay the money. You only need one, and that's what the Glazers are hoping to find. But they don't seem to have found that person yet.
Kieran, do you think Liverpool are in a better shape at the moment, or anywhere clearer or nearer to a sale? As opposed to, you know, just what you mentioned about Manchester United, the price is overpriced.
Well, certainly speaking to people I'm connected with, Fenway Sports Group are probably only looking for a 10 to 15% sale of Liverpool. They've tested the market. They've not really got a big response at the high levels of price. They paid $300 million for it from Hicks and Gillette. If they sold 10% of it, they could get their $300 million back and effectively have the best of both worlds, in that it's effectively therefore a zero cost to the owners, and they still own 90% of the club. Going forwards in football, the type of things that owners are looking for, which is a smaller Premier League, which would allow for, you know, an 18 team, ideally 16 is what they would like. That would mean more lucrative tours, more expanded European competitions, which are far more lucrative. To have 90% of that coming in would be very beneficial for those elite clubs, although for what you might call the mid-tier clubs, the likes of Aston Villa and Leeds and West Ham, it would be an absolute disaster.
Kieran, one thing we want to finish on is to leave the Premier League briefly, but talk about a team that is very much looking up the football pyramid, hoping to be there one day, and that's Wrexham. Now, they have captured the imagination with their celebrity owners, Ryan Reynolds and Rob McElhenney. Certainly, the documentary and the Hollywood element has brought unprecedented attention to Wrexham. But how much do you actually believe the club to be worth now relative to when it was purchased as a result of their unique ownership model?
Wrexham with Reynolds and McElhenney are worth a lot more than without. So I think the problem is that inherently the club is not worth a large sum of money. I've been to Wrexham as a fan. I've had great days out there, but it's not a wealthy area of the country. Therefore, the ability to monetize it comes through the owners rather than the club's inherent value. I think the owners, if they committed themselves to a new bidder, they said, well, we're going to stick with Wrexham, we commit ourselves for 10 to 15 years, then they could sell a proportion of the club at a higher price. But if they were to say, we're looking for a full sale, I don't see any value there, because the additional commercial income, there's no way that TikTok would be, Aviation Gin would be sponsors of Wrexham Football Club were it not for the two owners. So if you end up separating them by selling the club, you've got a problem.
Kieran, I was going to ask you, out of all the football models we've seen, ownership models, whether it's in this country or whether it's abroad, is there any model that you think is underutilised, something that would fit the Premier League really well, or even English football clubs? I mean, I'm a big fan of German football. I'm a big fan of the model of fan ownership, minimum 49%. Some clubs have 100% ownership with fans, and it's also proven to be successful. Union Berlin is a great example right now, currently in the Bundesliga, of 100% fan ownership. Do you see that potentially coming into the UK?
I think it's highly unlikely, and the reason for that is clubs of that nature have a natural ceiling because the clubs have to break even. Now, in order for that to work in the England, in the UK, first of all, you would have to deal with the Championship. And in the Championship, on average, clubs last season paid £120 in wages for every £100 in income. So therefore, they were already losing money before you put the floodlights on. They were already losing money before you went into the transfer market. And therefore, the only way that those clubs could survive was having owners who were prepared to subsidise and underwrite the losses. We do have some fan-owned clubs in the UK, and at League One and League Two level, I think there is a place for them. Above that, you don't have the resources in order to compete in the Championship. Once you get into the Premier League, things might be slightly easier, but I think the Championship itself is such a challenging, toxic mess in terms of the losses which are being made, that it wouldn't work in English football.
That should be a priority to change, right? The Championship, because you know this is where you're going to have problems with ownerships, with owners then running out of money, clubs going into financial difficulties, if you're continuously trying to rely on a wealthy owner to back your club, surely something's got to change that they do align more to a kind of either a fan ownership or it's certainly breaking even, sustainable method.
I agree with you absolutely, Mark. In theory, that's what you would hope the owners would want to do. But here's the problem. The club's breaking even. The club is in eighth position in the championship and we get to the January transfer window. The manager goes in and say, look, there's this striker. He's going to cost us a few million. His wages are higher than we're paying the rest of the squad. But I'm convinced he'll get 12 goals between now and the end of the season, get us into the playoffs, and then we're one step from the Premier League. And the owner says, here's the money. And you only need that to happen one or two times before it creates an arms race. So should we have regulations to prevent that? Yes, but the championship owners themselves have voted to not have a wage cap. They voted to not reduce the level of losses that they're currently allowed to have under the EFL's own cost control rules.
So do you think the Wrexham model is one of one? Do you think there could be copycats? And, I mean, Mark's asked you about one type of ownership model. Do you have a preferred realistic ownership model, Kieran, that you think could be replicated further down the football pyramid for those ambitious clubs, even if it is simply jumping from non-league to the Championship rather than necessarily from the Championship up to the Premier League?
I think a benevolent dictator, somebody who has the best interests of the club at heart, who also spends money smart rather than spends money full stop. If we take a look at Brentford, Brentford have got a 20,000 capacity, and that's their new stadium. The old one only held 12,000. They managed to get themselves from League One through to the Premier League through having a player spotting model. They didn't have an academy. They had a B team. They picked up kids at the age of 16 or 17 in London who had been jettisoned by Chelsea and Arsenal and Spurs and so on, and they developed them. They used data analytics. So it's a case of being perhaps a little bit different, having a long-term strategy. We always say in football, at the end of the season, the table doesn't lie. Well, what the Brentford owner Matthew Benham said is the table does lie, and they will be looking at metrics which will identify the reason why they got rid of their manager was they realized, or that they concluded, that he wasn't generating the additional gains that they were hoping to see, and that's the type of thing that's the route they go down. And it's the same, I'll be honest, I'm a Brighton fan. We've got an owner who's done exactly the same, where you spot talent through data analytics, you bring it across, you put it out on loan by having perhaps a satellite club, and both Brighton and Brentford have got satellite clubs elsewhere in Europe. The player develops for the first 12 months at the satellite club. They're then brought into the parent club. And if you look at Mitoma, you look at Caicedo, you look at McAllister, Brighton paid 16 million sterling for the three of them, and they could sell them for 150. So I think that type of model, but it does mean doing the boring stuff. It does involve talking to nerds.
I totally agree. I think any model needs smart people, and I don't think there's necessarily a right or wrong model, but you need people who can utilize the strength of clubs, see new possibilities, use new technology. Like Reynolds has done, he's used what he's good at and he has transferred that to Wrexham, and he's, he's grown that club, and obviously used some of his money as well. I think there's so many possibilities, but it's all about the right people with the right strategy that can actually take the club to a new level and use the money wisely.
Yeah, I think that's exactly the right word. Use it wisely. In respect of Wrexham, they also have the benefit of the highest wage bill in the fifth tier of English football. Not everybody's going to have that benefit. If it goes wrong, you end up with Everton, You know, that a new owner came in 2016. They spent $500 million on players. Some of those deals didn't work out. And again, you end up with players on legacy wages who are happy to sit out the contracts because Everton were beating everybody else apart from the top six. And where can the players go under those circumstances? Because they've got families, they've got financial commitments, and therefore they should be seeking to maximise their return from their skill set and their professionalism. And why should they take a pay cut? But that's the problem that Everton found.
Kieran, thank you for the chat. For our listeners in Australia that might be encountering your work for the first time, we'll give you the floor for a plug. Where else can we see, hear or read more of you?
Well, I do a podcast called The Price of Football. I do it with a stand-up comedian, and we look at the finances of the game, all of the different financial stories right from the bottom of the game through to the top. And it goes out twice a week and it's called The Price of Football. And I've written a book of the same name because I teach football finance, which many people will say is not a proper subject and it shouldn't be taught at university. But students love it.
Kieran, thank you for joining us.
Thank you.
Tired of ads interfering with your favorite sports podcasts? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Stay ahead of the game by downloading the Amazon Music app for free or go to amazon.com/sportsadfree. That's amazon.com/sportsadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.
Welcome back to the Gegen Pod. Socceroos icon Mark Schwarzer and former Premier League star Thomas Sorensen still with us in the pod. And unfortunately, Michael Bridges is in the United States of America and has been uncontactable via message. Mark Schwarzer, the floor is yours. Jesse Marsh sacked by Leeds United. Bridges' man is no longer at the helm.
All I was thinking was, poor Bridgie, he's in America. What about timing? It's all about timing, isn't it? And they decide to go and sack their American coach. How do you get out of that one? How do you explain to your American fans or the wannabe fans who have now just jumped ship because Jesse Marsh is no longer your manager? No surprise, to be perfectly honest with you. No surprise he's got, and not for any other reason other than results. The team just seemed to struggle. They've seemed to have hit a bit of a brick wall under Jesse Marsh for whatever reason, even though he's got, three or four American players there now. It just hasn't worked for him. And I actually have to say I'm probably a little bit surprised he's lasted this long, because I thought maybe, even during end of last season towards the summer, that maybe things would change. Because it didn't go very well towards the back end of last season. Unfortunate. No, never nice when someone loses their job, but it's no real surprise to me.
Yeah, no, I agree with you, Schwarzer. I think it was coming, certainly. I think results, obviously, and also some of the comments that's came out. I think he looked a bit defeated, frustrated. And, when you see that happening, it's obviously not ideal. And be interesting to see where they go from here. Do they go back to a former coach, or do they go a totally different direction? You've got the sporting director of football, Victor Orta, there, who's loves the Bielsa, the high press, and everything else, or do they actually try to get someone in that has a little bit of a different style? Because I think that's where Marsh struggled as well. He couldn't quite find that balance, and probably lacked Bamford in good form as well, a solid striker. But yeah, it'll be interesting to see where they go.
Well, Tommy, the new manager odds overnight in Australia had Carlos Corberan as evens favourite, but he signed a new contract with West Brom today. Marcelo Bielsa, Mauricio Pochettino, Ralf Hasenhüttl, Rafa Benitez, even Michael Carrick, and of course, inevitably, Ange Postecoglou, all named in the mix. Who do you hire next at Leeds?
No, like I said, Corberan, I think, would, he'll be the probably more direct. He's been at the club. He was there before he moved to Huddersfield Town. He's been around a few places. He was in Greece. Now he's obviously doing a great job at West Brom. So he knows everything about the club. He knows probably a lot of the players as well. But you know, will he move? And I think that's the big question for, you know, Michael Carrick has been mentioned as well, who's doing a good job in Middlesbrough. Ange, you know, who's in a great position at Celtic. Can you actually pry those coaches into a dogfight at the bottom of the Premier League, or do you go, you know? So I'm more entitled to think that Pochettino, or you know, someone who's out of a job, who's desperate to get back in, would take this on. You know, so I think Pochettino is probably, you know, the more likely in my view, but you know, who knows? I think it could go either way.
Yeah, I agree. I don't see Corberan leaving now West Brom, having signed a new contract, unless there's something about the deal and about a transfer fee, and maybe the only way it's going to work if there's a compensation fee for him to go and Leeds are prepared to pay. I just can't see it. Bielsa, I mean, even Bielsa being mentioned is kind of like, really? I mean, look, who knows? Football's strange. But I kind of think, you know, maybe a Pochettino, Ralf Hasenhüttl, maybe. You just never know. I can't see Ange for the life of me leaving Celtic right now. I don't think this is. It's all about timing for Ange, and that's certainly for me not the right timing. I think what he's doing at Celtic is phenomenal, and I think he'll want to go if he ever does leave Celtic. If he'll want to do it the right way because of the rapport that he's building with the fans. Can't see it. I don't think Benitez would be a fit at all. And just in the people that listed here, and I think Michael Carrick, you know what? He is doing an excellent job at Middlesbrough. I just, again, go back to timing. I don't think would be the right move for him right now. I think he needs to continue to do what he's doing at Middlesbrough and then see where he goes from there, because I think for the fact that he's even mentioned is a credit to how well he's been doing so far in the Championship and how he's turned Middlesbrough's fortunes around. And I just want to see him go for another 12 months or so, learning his trade and really trying to hone his skills and maybe do something special in Championship and promotion, and then from that have another step up.
Well, thanks to our friends at Opta, I can tell you that if you sack your manager while in the relegation zone, you have a 39% success rate of surviving over the life of the Premier League. Whereas if you sack your manager a couple of places outside the relegation zone, for example, what Aston Villa did with Steven Gerrard, replacing him with Unai Emery, then it goes up to 83%. So acting at the right time is crucial. Leeds have waited until now. Let's move on to Liverpool and their issues. Jurgen Klopp, a meltdown, well, a gruff press conference, not a total meltdown. It wasn't Mourinho's respect, respect, respect. But the cracks are well and truly opening up, Mark Schwarzer. Will he resign? And what can Liverpool possibly do from here with Klopp at the helm?
Well, which one do I answer first? Cracks appearing. Look, has to. The pressure has to be mounting. Frustration, pressure, all of that would be building, because he'd be like beside himself in what's gone wrong, how the team has crumbled, how it's fallen away, the players' lack of response in a lot of way, so many players out of form, so many things going against him. He'd be thinking as well, 7 years, Dortmund, this. And it's not nice to see, I have to be honest, you know, because obviously what he's accomplished at Liverpool has been absolutely amazing, and the style of football they've played. But to see him right now, they're a shadow of themselves. I can't see them for the life of me finishing in a Champions League position. I think at this rate, they'll be lucky to finish even in a European place. I don't know. I think Liverpool's got a really big decision to make come the summer. And the decision will be, there's two clear options. You either part way with a manager, or you have a complete rebuild. And, you know, both of them are quite dramatic in some ways, in their own different ways. And I think it's anyone's guess which way it will go. But if I'm a betting man, which I'm not, but if I were going to put something up, I maybe would put on something like Klopp maybe coming to an agreement with a club that they may part ways if it continues the same way between now and the season.
Yeah, I don't quite agree with you, Sports. I don't think there's a need for a total rebuild. I think I think they've got plenty of players. I think definitely in the middle of the park. I think this season has shown that they are, you know, worn out legs there with Thiago, obviously Henderson, But you know, I think Jota coming back, Diaz coming back, you know, Van Dijk is out. I think the spine of the team in general, if they can get a Bellingham, you know, get some youth, some quality in that midfield in the summer, I don't think they're far off. But there is obviously worries that there's some tiredness, you know, that you can just see that the energy and the morale that Liverpool were so strong at, you know, that area over the last couple of years, or at least the last 5 years under Klopp, have waned a little bit now. You can just see they're just crumbling. They look, it just doesn't look the same team. And that's the worrying part. And I think that's where the decision, is he at his sell-by date now? Or, you know, is there something that's not quite right there? You know, that I think that's the big question, because I think the squad is good enough with a few additions.
I think the reason I say rebuild, total rebuild, the total rebuild is if Jürgen Klopp stays as manager. Because I think it's about change of voice. There's certainly probably four or five players, you're right, there that it's probably, they're not at that level anymore. They've dropped off, they've struggled, maybe they need a change. I think if Jürgen Klopp were to stay, I think there's going to be, well, I think there would need to be quite a number of changes, because they need to freshen things up, different players to hear different, you know, hear that voice, get a different response, because at the moment it doesn't seem like anything he's doing is getting a response that you're used to seeing from Liverpool players and a Jurgen Klopp side.
Let's go right down to the foot of the table. There are already reports emerging that Southampton may sack Nathan Jones after only 13 games in charge. Thomas, this has been a desperate struggle for Southampton. It was an eyebrow-raising appointment. Do you think there's merit to this? Does Southampton have to act now before it's too late? I mean, I know we're in February, but the World Cup break means they do have a few more games up their sleeve than they normally would at this time of the year.
Yeah, no, I think under normal circumstances, you would say exactly that. But I think that press conference that Nathan Jones had, you know, totally killed that. You know, if I was in that dressing room and I heard my manager, you know, talk like that, you know, I think, you know, I would lose faith, for sure. You know, just trying to blame everyone else around you, you know, that he couldn't play the style he wanted to play, like he did at Luton, and I think it's just a big bad excuse and trying to cover his own ass. And I think when you start to see that, I think there's only one way. I can't see the players backing him. I don't think I would if I was there. So sadly, I don't think, you know, a little bit like what happened at Stoke as well, you know, just worn out his welcome pretty quickly. And yeah, I don't know if it's his personality or what is, and with the results not going great as well, I think I would be surprised if he's gone pretty quickly.
Yeah, I agree. I think when you start to make up excuses, you start to point the finger, push the blame to other people when you're the manager, you lose people very, very quickly. And I mean, yeah, I think it's only a matter of when it's going to happen as opposed to if it's going to happen. I just don't see that changing. I mean, players will certainly have their hackles up now with what the manager's been saying.
Let's leave the Premier League there and go to your latest activities, Mark Schwarzer. You caught up with Alu Kwol to talk about his life in Germany at Stuttgart and also the Puskas Award. That's going to be rolling out on Optus Sport channels over the coming week. What was that experience like, and how was it catching up with Alu Kwol?
It was really nice. Alu, you know, he's very, very chilled, very relaxed. Talked to him about, you know, about his brother and about whether he's been to Edinburgh as yet, which he said he had been a couple of times, and talked about the fact that obviously, you know, he got made his debut in the Bundesliga with Stuttgart the other week, what that was like, how excited he was to make that debut, and then of course the Puskas nomination and the goal. And it was pretty funny actually, because he talked about, you know, he was, like I said, he's like one of the most chilled men I've ever come across. And he talked about, you know, backheel scorpion kick that he scored. And it was almost like, yeah, you know, I do it at training quite a lot. So, yeah, it was good. It was kind of cool. And he was so, like I said, he was very, very good. It was nice to have a chat to him as well.
Swartz, how do you sense that his personality will fit in Germany? Because obviously you've been there more than me, but it always seems to come out that, you know, the Germans, you know, that's you got to be spot on in your attitude and everything else, and if you're too laid back, is that going to hinder him, or Could it be an advantage for him?
It's more about the discipline, right? So, you know, I think the Germans are very much on the discipline. As long as he's doing that, and I'm pretty sure he is, because otherwise he wouldn't be in around the first team. He did mention the cold and how he struggles with a cold. That's something he still hasn't gotten used to, which is understandably, because it was freezing in Germany. I think Germany's changed a lot as well. We see players from all over the world now. It's a hub of young, really exciting, young, talented players as well coming to the Bundesliga, get given opportunities to play. It's almost a nursery of highly talented football players and breeding ground, and they develop them and utilize them as much as they can, and then they upsell them. And I think Alou's in a great position. I think it's a really good league for him to learn the discipline side, learn the professionalism side of it, but also getting that invaluable experience playing first team football. I think he's in a great place to be right now.
And just lastly, gentlemen, Kevin Muscat's Yokohama F Marinos, the defending J-League champions, they are playing in the Japanese Super Cup against Ventforet Kofu. Can they win this game? And more importantly, can Kevin Muscat defend his J-League title? I am a little bit surprised that the prying eyes of Europe have not lured him away from Yokohama F Marinos, but clearly he's committed to coming back and trying to repeat as champion.
You know, first of all, I think they're going to win the Super Cup. I think, he did a great job. It came down to the wire, you know, even though they were pretty comfortable at a certain point last season. Lost a few games late on, but held on and... just taking over there from Ange, you know, just doing the same. I think, you know, if he's patient, he's got to get an opportunity. I think he's a similar personality. You know, he's very charismatic. I played against him as a player. I saw him when he was at Victory. And, you know, when we played with Melbourne City, you know, and he has that effect on his players. So he's going to lift everyone. And you can see now, we look at the Premier League, we look at Dyche, you know, he's come in at Everton. And these managers will be in demand. You know, the players, someone that the players can, aspire to and attract to and can inspire them. So for sure, he'll be in Europe at some point. He just needs to be patient.
Yeah, I think he just needs to continue the work that he's doing. Yeah, can they win it? Yes, absolutely, they can win it. I think he's done an excellent job taking over from Ange. I mean, Ange does very, very well whenever he leaves a club. He's one of those managers, and there's not many of them that leave clubs in a healthier state than when he first arrived. And the team's still intact, and for a manager just to take over and add their own little bits and pieces to it. I think Muskie's done that really, really well at Yokohama. And look, we're already seeing it. Ange is obviously doing incredibly well in Scotland with Celtic. Turned a 25-point deficit before he arrived in Scotland to winning the league with Celtic, and he's going to win the league this year again. I've got no doubt about it. They're by far the best team in Scotland, and we see Paddy's Cusnorbo over in France, and I think it's only a matter of time before we get more and more. Ange will eventually, I believe, at some stage, take another step up again and end up either at one of the top leagues in the world. I really believe so. And again, it'll keep putting Aussie names, Aussie managers on the radar. And Muskie keeps doing his thing in the J League and has another successful season. There's no doubt in my eyes either that he'll end up being in Europe somewhere at a really good club.
Thomas Sorensen, Mark Schwarzer, it's been a bit of a different Gegenpod, but a very fun one. Thanks for your company today, and look forward to catching up with you again soon.
Thanks to you.
Cheers, guys.
Yes, a big thanks to Mark Schwarzer, Thomas Sorensen, and earlier in the show, Kieran Maguire. The Premier League has a Thursday blockbuster when Manchester United host Leeds United from 7 a.m. Australian Eastern Daylight Time, and then at the weekend see West Ham versus Chelsea from 11:30 p.m., then Goal Rush from 2 a.m. Sunday morning, including Tottenham's trip to Leicester and Arsenal against Brentford. On Monday, it's Leeds hosting Manchester United from 1 a.m. Australian Eastern Daylight Time, followed by Man City against Aston Villa from 3:30 a.m. And there's a Tuesday morning match as well, with the Merseyside Derby, Liverpool hosting Everton from Anfield at 7 a.m. Australian Eastern Daylight Time. La Liga continues with a Saturday morning showdown between Cadiz and Girona from 7 a.m. And you can see Barcelona's trip to Villarreal on Monday morning at 7 a.m. And the WSL continues with a huge contest filled with Matilda's stars, kicking off at 11:30pm Australian Eastern Daylight Time on Saturday when Manchester City host Arsenal. One of four live games, all exclusive on Optus Sport. Make sure to hit subscribe wherever you get your podcasts, and why not rate us 5 stars while you're there. I'm your host, Teo Pelizzeri. Thanks for your company this week on the Optus Sport Football Podcast. You've been listening to the Gegenpod.
Tired of ads interfering with your favorite sports podcasts? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Stay ahead of the game by downloading the Amazon Music app for free or go to amazon.com/sportsadfree. That's amazon.com/sportsadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.